Alliance, implementing the strongest possible protections will require EPA to fill gaps on critical issues such as frequent inspections for smaller wells and a ban on routine flaring when it finalizes the rule later next year. These must be strongly addressed before the proposal is finalized to ensure EPA is protecting frontline communities from pollution and meeting this moment to tackle the climate crisis. Anything less is a missed opportunity that could have dire consequences. Adding to the case for rapid decarbonization, another study published last week found that slashing air pollution emissions from energy-related sources would prevent more than 50,000 premature deaths and save $608 billion per year in the U.S. alone. The oil and gas threat map, meanwhile, shows 17 million living, breathing reasons to strengthen EPA's methane proposal. Lauren Pagel, Earthworkers director, said, "Pollution-prone oil and gas wells should not be exempt from frequent monitoring, and no company should be able to burn off methane as waste," Pagel added. But no matter how strong these rules are, climate justice during a climate emergency means using every tool in the toolbox, including declaring a national emergency on climate change.
This is Back to Reality.
Back to Reality.
It's the show where we discuss the most topical of topics, the most controversial of controversies, and the most important affairs of affairs.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Assalamu alaikum, dear listeners. You're listening to the IRIB English Radio. This is Back to Reality, and I am your host, Zainab Askari. In this program, we do a roundtable discussion on the very interesting topics. And today also, we're going to discuss one of the very interesting topics with two of the very special guests. I have with me Siddique on my left side and Fatima on my right side. I would want you guys to introduce yourself. Let's start from Fatima.
Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah. My name is Fatima Peabody. I'm from Southern California, U.S. I've been here in Qom this time a little over 5 years. I studied a little bit at Jamatul Zahra Hawza. Since then, I'm just teaching a little bit of English conversation classes here and there and just attending lectures and my own kind of self-study, enjoying the Qom life.
Well, thank you, Fatima. Nice to meet you.
How are you,
Siddique? Let's know something about you, too.
Thank you. Yes, my name is Siddique. I am from the UK, specifically London. And I've been in Qom as well for around 5 to 6 years now. And I study in Bint al-Huda. My field of specialization is fiqh and usul, which basically deals with jurisprudence, the nitty-gritty of how the rules are derived.
True. So nice to meet both of you.
Thank you.
All right. So today we'll discuss about a very interesting topic that everyone is talking about, that's trending all the time. That's love. Siddique, I'll start from you. What's love?
Okay. First, we need to know the difference between love and lust.
And infatuation.
Infatuation. Exactly.
Yes. Wow.
What
attraction.
We usually,
so many things.
Yeah. So what? Love is sacred. You know, Allah talks about love in the Quran. He talks about loving the Prophet, and Allah will love you. You know, he talks about mawadda. He talks about the verse where the Prophet says, "I do not ask of any reward from you apart from love for my family." Mm-hmm. Love is sacred. Love is what is between you and Allah. Even that love can be projected in your family. Like Allah says, when you marry, I will come and put love and rahmah within you.
Wow.
So love is sacred. Lust is not. Lust is required in a relationship, in a valid marriage relationship. That is absolutely important. But apart from that, when we start crossing the barriers, then it's no longer sacred. But then today, with the word love is used so loosely, the people have lost the real meaning of it.
Mm-hmm.
And if we see again Sahifa Sajjadiyah, the whispered prayers of Imam Sajjad alayhi salam. One of them is the whispered prayers of the lovers, and he goes into this whole conversation with Allah, explain to him how much I love you.
That's
true
love.
If I find you, why would I want to go to anyone else? Mm-hmm. Imam Hussein as well, right? And Karbala, one who has found you, what has he lost? And one who has lost you, what has he found? Those are absolute descriptions of true, pure love.
Yes.
I'm not saying love is restricted to between you and Allah. It's there with it, but Allah instills that love within your family as well.
Yes, yes.
That's why it says, if you marry, I will give you that love.
True.
And that's why marriage, which is based on the pure foundations that Allah has spoken about, alhamdulillah, many marriages go on to have very successful futures. Yes, some marriages are not successful, but there are reasons, and inshallah, those can be worked upon.
Yeah, and we have also in Surah Maidah that if they love him, he loves them too. And yes, we have that. You said love is sacred. I really agree with that. And in India, again, mm-hmm. I'll go back to India. In India also, they say, yes, love can be sacred, but the love that is being, advertised so much, that is being shown, is not the true love. And the sacred one, love, is given a different term that's called as ishq. Dear listeners, stay tuned to IRIB English Radio.
This is IRIB English Radio. You're listening to Back to Reality.
I would want to ask you, Fatima, since you're from California, what is love?
First, between the servant and Allah, and our love for Ahlul Bayt alayhi salam, all of those really the spiritual things, number one. The first true love is between us and Allah, and if we can, to the Prophet and Ahlul Bayt. But I think a lot of people, especially in the West, they're so confused because there's just so much emphasis on attraction, infatuation, lust, just getting what you want right away. I think with true love, it takes time. You're not going to get a true love, you just talk to the person for a few days and then boom, let's get married. That's attraction and lust and infatuation and admiration too. I think there's a lot of sisters, as myself, my problem in the previous marriage. Admiration, like intellectual admiration, like you're so amazed by their intellect and
you're obsessed with someone.
Yeah, and he's studying perfect, even though he's not a native speaker. These are intellectual admirations and infatuations. This is not a true love.
All right.
So I think it's very, very rare. It's very, very rare. That's why divorce is on the rise. The U.S., it's like more than 50% of marriages end in divorce, even among Muslim, non-Muslim.
And
because they don't understand. No, they don't really understand what is the true love. You know?
And talking about U.S., we have so many single parents.
Yeah.
We have so many single parents or they're like, maybe after having a kid, they realize that they never loved that person.
Yeah, yeah.
And this is happening so
much. And having a child with somebody, it's kind of like you have unless you're going to, God forbid, abandon your child.
Yeah.
You're going, even if you're living separately from the child, you're always going to have a certain connection. If the person is suffering from all kind of, mental illnesses or other thing, and you cut off, still, whenever you see the child, obviously going to remind you. So having a child with somebody, it never finishes that connection until the child grow up and whatever. But it still doesn't create how you can have 10 kids and live with somebody 50 years and still not have a true love. It's not going to. The true love comes from Allah. And I think only Allah, it's a kind of a blessing from Allah. He only instills it in you. And then I think also it's happened to a lot of people that I know, and I just know about it, that it starts off after our connection to Allah and that true love. If we had, I know this from psychology and reading and experiencing, if we had healthy caregivers in the early childhood, because the girls develop faster than the boys, if as women we had in the early childhood from, they say around the time of 3 to 4 years old to 5 years old, your personality starts forming until you reach the balagha age. If you had caregivers who were loving to you, expressing love to you, and parenting you correctly, especially the mother and the father both, especially girls need from the father, then you develop that self-esteem and love for yourself, mm-hmm. then you're going to be more able to recognize. It's easier, I think, to see, even though some people that had that still have hardship, but I think it's a little bit easier than those who didn't have it. You don't have a love for yourself, then you're going to have more danger later on. You got to be careful for that and
True.
Choosing the correct partner, spouse.
Choosing the correct.
There's a very interesting point that you mentioned about love and relationships, children and everything. What I do want to sort of point to is that some people, and this is unfortunate, but it does happen, especially in some marriages, some relationships, abusive relationships especially, the husband might say, I'm hitting you because I love you. Please don't be fooled. That's not love.
Wow.
Right? If anyone is in an abusive relationship, you need to take help, right? And often love is misused in different dimensions, right? Someone might mistake lust to be love, and someone might stay in an abusive relationship under the pretext that they're yeah. love.
You manipulation. Said someone, it's a
you
manipulation.
Said someone might mistake lust as love. We have girls growing up who, unfortunately, I know most of them, get least care from home because of anything can be the reason. Like maybe the parents are not expressive all the time. But parents always love.
A mother always loves. The father has to father love has the to daughter be, like, correctly
everyone,
or she's going to have issues.
I don't say that
yeah.
parents don't love their kids, but it might be the problem of expression. Sometimes
expressing
parents
their love,
not
yeah.
Are not able to express their love to their kids. And when these kids grow up and someone
outside issue.
Comes in, tells in their teens them, I love you. And they straight away get slipped. And as you correctly mentioned, that they take lust as love. How can they be protected? I ask you, Siddiqa.
Parents need to express love to the children. You know I can understand how it can be a bit difficult for men, especially men who are not very expressive.
Mm-hmm.
But there's some very good techniques. Like when you're talking to a child, mm-hmm. especially those in the toddler years,
True.
Lower yourself to the eye level.
Yeah.
When you're talking to them, lower yourself so they feel they're on the same page as you.
Yeah.
Then you start to build a connection with them.
Mm-hmm.
A child will always come and tell you, and you know, even if they're joking, they might come and tell you, "I love you."
Yeah.
If respond, even if you're feeling a bit shy, it's okay. Respond. Respond. Let the child know you are there for them.
Mm-hmm.
A lot of the times as well, you know, children, they might act out at home.
Yeah.
And some people suggest, now I'm not giving a general blanket sort of statement, but mm-hmm. in some cases it does come up because they want attention.
Yeah.
Attention in the form of love, you know, just a hug. You can't say, I love you, hug the child.
Yeah.
Touch the child. You know, let them feel that you're there for them.
Dear listeners, stay tuned to IRIB English Radio.
Please send any suggestion, any idea to our email, that is englishradio@irib.ir.
Welcome back. You're listening to IRIB English Radio. This is Back to Reality, where we are having a roundtable discussion on love. Prophet Muhammad, may peace be upon him and his family, said, tell your wives in the Uhud book, I love you. And most of the men, especially men, are so much least expressive. Got,
yeah.
I'm done with these men. I mean, my brothers,
depend on
all
their
the men
parents,
I know.
It depends on their parents too, how they raise them. Yeah.
And I think there's one more thing, you know, women sometimes, women are most expressive. They sometimes
yeah.
get gifts and they get, I don't know, flowers for the husband. They get so many things for the husbands. But then, does this husband really need the gifts?
No.
Or does he need power? What do you think?
I think he needs the respect and to feel that he's needed. Because the biggest problem, I think, in the Western culture and then all these countries over here, especially the youth here, they're trying to copy the West. Everybody's so excited about the West. And I want to go study abroad and they want to copy the Western culture.
Mm-hmm.
Is that the woman is like this so independent and she can get a job. She can earn the money. She can earn even more than him and do everything. Take care of the kids. Take care of the house. Take care of the bills. So then what's left? Like if she's doing everything, you know, and then cook and clean and like everything she's doing, then what is he going to be there? Just to come and like pay for like a couple of little bills and then like, okay, what, you know, he has to feel like he's needed. and he has to feel like he's respected in the house. And I think that's one of the biggest problem in the West. They're not respected. They just feel like, okay, what's the point of me being here? You know, just to have some babies and bring a little bit of, pay a couple of bills. What else am I here for?
You know, yeah, well, I think that respect is a problem both in the West and in Asia as well. Yeah. I come from India, and I know that people are so much hungry for this respect that they sometimes even misuse that respect. They so much downgrade women. They think that she's just like they consider her as a slave, while as Islam has given her a very, very highest positions, like I must say sometimes somewhere more than men. Well, thank you so much, guys, for coming on the show. We came to the conclusion that love is sacred and lust is something that is sometimes misunderstood as love. There is infatuation, there is admiration, there is lust.
Emotional manipulation, using people for money and other things. These are all different.
These are all different things, and we need to understand what is real love. And we have a request to the parents that you love your children, we know that, but express that love, because if you're not going to express that love, maybe someone telling them outside, I love you, will get them dragged to some other track. So be expressive. Everyone who loves their loved ones, their partners, their children need to express this. Expressing love is really
important.
And
I think people should get a little bit of counseling too before getting married, not just getting married so quick, you know?
Yeah. So counseling is important. Knowing people is important. Knowing each other is important. Thank you so much, Sadiqa. Thank you so much, Fatima. Thank you so much for being with us. You were listening to IRIB English Radio. This was Back to Reality. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
يا الله يا رب العالمين يا رحمن يا رحيم يا ربي let the ummah rise again يا الله يا رب العالمين يا رحمن يا رحيم يا ربي Let the Ummah rise again. Let us see daylight again, once again.
Join us in this journey. IRIB English Radio. Log on to our website www.parstoday.com/en.
Lawmaker has said,
contrary to Washington's claims, America's
President Raisi has emphasized that
U.S. sanctions have failed to extract concessions from Tehran.
Iran Today.
It was the second longest war of the 20th century after the Vietnam War. Physically imposed on this country on September the 22nd, 1980, the Iraq-Iran War took 8 years. A major turning point on what could have been ultimate victory for Iran came in 1982. That was ultimately thanks to Operation Beit al-Muqaddas, which on May the 24th, or Khordad the 3rd, liberated the southwestern port city of Khorramshahr. That's county seat of oil-rich Khuzestan province bordering Iraq. They lost their lives or lost their loved ones, with their hometown turning into a museum city. That's the people of Khorramshahr, known for its resistance and war. Khorramshahr has no less than 25 spots noteworthy of war tourism. This Holy Defense Museum, or Sacred Defense Museum in Tehran, is a reminder of its losses and victory that ensued from a nation's resistance and the military's strategizing. Stay with me, Leila Faramarzi, on Iran Today. On the 40th anniversary of the victory of Operation Beit al-Muqaddas, or Operation Jerusalem, we'll be hearing of technicalities that guaranteed its success. For that, I present a major architect of the operations, although he talks of them in the context of earlier operations. That would be Mr. Bakhtiari, General Bakhtiari, who joined us in Press TV studios. What I'm asking is that you give me some military technical details of the Beit al-Muqaddas operations, because they did become operational. How accurately had you planned them?
Beit al-Muqaddas farzand amaliyat fath al-mubin.
Operation Beit al-Muqaddas is birthed by Operation Fath al-Mubin. Fath al-Mubin is birthed by Tariq al-Quds, and Tariq al-Quds is birthed by Sa'amu al-Amme. And they are all the children of the army's efforts in the first year to stop the enemy's war machine. So Beit al-Muqaddas was a form of mindset or estimation that I'll do so and so once I've done so and so, but not in detail, rather from the standpoint of general pre-planning. So officers and those working on this plan started on preparing this plan once former plans made a breakthrough. If I say too much, you'll think I'm bragging about my work or job. But it's actually a truth foreign military experts also agree on, that Beit al-Muqaddas were special operations for execution and given the difficulty and detailed planning they took. And they refer to the fighting ability of warriors on the ground, because architects plan for those on the ground to execute, executing which is as good as playing with their own lives.
The trigger to all counter-offensives was pulled some 42 years ago on September the 22nd, when Iraqi forces launched airstrikes on Iranian air bases, following up with a ground invasion of Khuzestan. With Iran taken somewhat by surprise, the invasion was initially successful, and Iraq captured Khorramshahr and made other territorial gains by November. But then came Iraq's turn to be taken by surprise. Contrary to expectation, it was faced by resonated resistance on the part of Iranians. While the Air Force takes first credit for spectacular performance in the early days of the war or Holy Defense, the Army Aviation is associated with a majority of operations carried out during the war, especially the operation codenamed Beit al-Muqaddas.
No one thought Iraq had progressed so far. They thought the Air Force had attempted another coup, but saw it was Iraqi planes. There are lots of accounts given Iraq's confidence and complacency. Say Saddam came to the Ministry of Defense. The minister and Tariq Aziz tell Saddam, "Sire, the country's youth have gone to finish off the enemy, Iran." The film exists. Saddam looks at his watch and says, "See, it takes no more than half an hour."
These armed forces were echoed and backed by popular forces, the revolutionary militia, you could say. In 1981, Iran launched a counteroffensive, and by early 1982, it had regained all lost territory. We went down to Parliament to meet Mr. Saadati, once the Khuzestan Sepah commander and now MP.
خوزستان عزیز ما که مورد طمع هست به هر حال حیاتی ترین استان بعد از پایتخت خوزستان.
Khuzestan is the most vital province after the capital and so always has eyes on it. It holds 80% of our oil resources and 20% of our gas as well as fertile soil and water in abundance. More important are its great people of 5 million made up of different ethnicities: Arabs, Persians, Lurs, Bakhtiaris, Qanavatis, all Shia. They're living side by side in unity in their border province.
By the end of that year, 1982, Iraqi forces had withdrawn to pre-war border lines, and Iraq conveniently attempted to seek peace. But Iran saw fit to continue till it topples the restless regime of Saddam Hussein.
The Iraqis even said after their miserable defeat that they wanted to make peace. Our imam said, it was you that started the war, but okay, our conditions for peace are that you admit you were the aggressor and to return borders to their original state. But it was obviously a ruse and they wanted to reassemble and re-attack. But we read this and the war continued with great further victories for Iran. Although the imam said, commanders, do not get conceited, as it was God that liberated Khorramshahr.
Why Iraq's Ba'athist president Saddam Hussein decided on a preemptive strike against Iran, thinking it'll take him just 3 days to run this country down, our guest tells.
Saddam Hussein,
Saddam had an inherent hate for us Iranians and great prejudice for the Arab race and people of Iraq. Also, psychologically, he had great ambition to lead the Arab world like Jamal Abdel Nasser. But he had several rivals like Hafez Assad, the then Syrian president. In those days, the Pastoran Sepah, or IGC, were not organized and the Basij forces neither belonged to Sepah nor were they a unit. Rather, they were local to city districts. The only organized force was the army, and that too had its problems.
Operation Beit al-Muqaddas was an extensive operation pulled off in swathes. The first attack, which was from April the 24th to May the 12th, 1981, utilized approximately 70,000 army troops and IRGC members, then known as Pastaran. The forces succeeded in pushing Iraqi forces out of the Ahvaz-Susangerd area. The Iraqis withdrew back to Khorramshahr and a week later, on May the 20th, launched an unsuccessful counterattack.
In the great operation Beit al-Muqaddas, the Sepah Aviation, the Sepah Air Force did all that was possible, as did surface-to-air and air-to-surface defenses. They broke a record given possibilities. After all, with sanctions, we needed parts we were not given for helicopters and planes. Those are needed with every few flights, so the men tried to reduce flights, not to have to change parts too often.
The Khorramshahr operation was planned in such a way that the Iraqis, in spite of all preparation, found themselves diving into Arvandrud or Arvand River to escape. They didn't succeed. The operation was so vast that it covered from 20 kilometers from Ahwaz and Hamidiya up to Shalamche and Khorramshahr that the scores of soldiers sent in by Iraq were either captured or sent to hell. This is in spite of its heavy bombing of Iran, even chemical bombing. They found themselves to be no match for Iranian soldiers who fought by belief.
Iran responded to the counterattack with an all-out assault. Iranians finally gathered around the Arvandrud waterway, surrounded the city, and began a second siege. It was on May the 24th that, after 2 days of bitter fighting, Iranians finally recaptured the city. They also captured a substantial amount of Iraqi military hardware and 19,000 Iraqi soldiers. Saddam Hussein, furious and shocked, ordered the execution of a number of top Iraqi officers for losing the city they'd invaded. What remains of the wall may be the occasional ruins or this reminder, a museum stretched over 21 hectares to recreate the liberation of Khorramshahr and other occupied areas by means of video projections and all sorts of exhibits. But at the time, in the 1980s, it was a very real matter of life and death, of saving every last inch of our soil. It's a select collection we got to visit in the mostly open-air Holy Defense Museum. I doubt there's anything by way of war memorabilia missing there, from helmets to medals to downed Iraqi planes, and even a lifelike figure of General Soleimani were there waiting for the viewing. Anyway, to hear of the war, I had to meet living examples of the soldier.
When we embarked on the Fath al-Mubin operation, we had very limited possibilities. Say, in the whole operation area, we had only 11 tanks and personal carriers, whereas Iraq had over 700 tanks and personal carriers. To make up for the shortcomings, we had to get creative. Say, the brave commander Mutawassilian in the Fath al-Mubin operations insisted we must first engage the enemy's artillery, because otherwise, as we got engaged in line, their artillery would shower us with fire. So, as ordered, six of us were selected to detect the artillery. We proceeded 24 kilometers deep into enemy lines, up to the Ali Gherzel Hills, where we detected the artillery and counted to find they had 94 cannons. And we struck the artillery on the night of operations.
Now, there's a pretty big difference between formal military training and tactics and asymmetric warfare, which is how the Sepah or IRGC, Revolution Guards Corps, and popular forces automatically entered the scene with. So it made me wonder how these two forces, the army or Artesh on the one hand and the IRGC and affiliates on the other hand, work together to pull off operations with such accuracy, meaning the Beit al-Muqaddas operations, basically.
Given different strategies and training and this and that, how exactly did the army and Sepah or IRGC come to terms? How did they coordinate to pull the operations off?
As for planning, well, every operation takes planning, but that too was based on possibilities and not in the style of classical organized armies. It was a tactical difference between Sepah and Artesh, the IRGC, and army. And after the Beit al-Muqaddas and Fath al-Mubin operations, the army functioned separately and the Sepah separately. The army would engage the enemy so the Sepah could attack from another side. Fighting in two camps increased productivity.
We are talking lots of action that bore results, but such an extensive operation couldn't have worked without meticulous pre-planning. Still, according to a senior military commander quoted by the YJC, the Young Journalists Club, the Jerusalem operation or Beit al-Muqaddas operation was a symbol of coordination and solidarity between the army and the IRGC. In this operation, the whole country, including the financial and military resources, the IRGC and army came to the fore. And with the engineering role of the army, all its infantry and artillery units went to work and a historic success was achieved.
Plenty more on a true story that no words are enough to describe. But first, a quick media review to see what other news outlets have said. Here's how they've put it in writing. Now, in 2018, with the sanctions, Iran's military spending and budget took a plunge. But Cipri has shown good improvements from 2021 onwards. However, Bursan Bazar claims Cipri has overstated Iran's military spending for years. Cipri SIPRI, the Stockholm International Peace Research Institute, produces the world's most authoritative data on global military expenditure and the arms trade. The Cipri Yearbook, a flagship annual publication, offers civilian and military leaders around the world a way to compare military spending between countries and to gauge which countries are investing in greater military power. This year, the Cipri Yearbook includes some significant statements about Iran's military expenditure, which is estimated at over $24.5 billion. In a fact sheet summarizing key trends, Cipri's researchers declared Iran increased its military spending by 11%
making it the 14th largest military spender in 2021. This is the first time in 20 years that Iran has ranked among the top 15 military spenders. We've got a piece from the Tehran Times that reads, Iran's advanced military technology luring customers. The drone production unit was opened in Tajikistan's capital at the presence of Iran's armed forces chief of staff, Mohammad Bagheri, and Tajik defense minister, General Shirali Mirzo. The production of Ababil II, an all-Iranian UAV in Dushanbe, is intended to increase defense and military cooperation between Iran and Tajikistan. The factory was built with the assistance of specialists from the Iranian Ministry of Defense. The first essential aspect that this brings to mind is that unlike many other countries in West Asia, Iran is willing to share its technological knowledge with other countries. The fact that Iran and Tajikistan have agreed to strengthen defensive cooperation demonstrates that Iranian defensive knowledge has many potential clients. However, most countries are scared of the world's biggest bully imposing illegal extraterritorial sanctions and hence refuse to work with Iran. However, Tajikistan is showing its affinity to Iran by pledging to cooperate with Tehran. Given that Iran is subject to illegal severe sanctions for importing and exporting defense technology and weaponry, this collaboration will be even more significant. Also, Iran's dependence on domestic technology in creating military equipment is proving appealing to the West Asian market. Iran's cooperation with Tajikistan can serve as a model for West Asia if they abandon their subordination to the U.S. and live in a fearless world. That'll be it for the news section. Resistance and the reward that came with it, that's winning back one's lands, is not something to just vanish in time. Rather, the liberation of Khorramshahr played a key role in later political and military developments. These altered regional equations, demonstrating how Iran is a new or renewed power in the West Asia region. The war taught Iran that its domestic defense and external operations need to rely on layered defenses and asymmetric responses.
ما همیشه رو پای خودمون الحمدلله ما الان از نظر بازدارندگی تو منطقه حرف اول رو میزنیم.
Today we are number one in deterrence in the region. That's to say we'll really make the enemy regret any attack on us, even if we are not as well equipped. That's because we'll return one missile with 10, as advised by the leader. Hopefully our economy grows as strong as our military capability. But anyway, as an example of our strength in the Beit al-Muqaddas operation, we in the 27th Muhammad Rasulullah Brigade, led by Haj Ahmad Mutawassilian, were at the westernmost point that's closest to Khorramshahr city. Well, Iraq really didn't expect the tactic we employed. Iraq had come into Khorramshahr thinking that we would complete our operation and just slide into Khorramshahr via an asphalted road for him to massacre us. He even had all his traps and tanks and whatnot laid ready to kill us off. But it didn't happen.
By 2020, the Iranian military was recognized as the eighth largest in the world based on active personnel and suited to pursue a strategy of asymmetrical warfare. This was after the U.S. imposed its maximum pressure sanctions on this country in 2018, limiting our military exports. In terms of overall military strength, the Iranian armed forces ranked 14th in the world as of 2019 out of 137 countries, going by figures presented by Global Firepower. Given sanctions and reduced imports and cheaper hardware imports, Iran has had to increasingly depend on developing domestic technologies for its military needs. This country relies quite a lot on the development of missiles to overcome the disadvantage of having less military equipment. This country is recognized as having the most developed short and medium-range missile system in the region. As one example alone, it has 300-kilometer-range Shahab-1 missiles. This moved Washington to install a Patriot anti-aircraft system in some neighboring countries to counter possible missile threats from Iran. We've also got a Shahab-3 missile with a range of up to 2,000 kilometers as a deterrent of last resort.
We're now so powerful and independent missile-wise that we can attack any point or vessel anywhere trying to attack us. This is why so many were saying that today is a time for talks and not missiles. But the leader wouldn't have that. Good thing, or the enemy would have swallowed us alive. But our missile was strong enough to strike the American UAV down at the border. Otherwise, we'd end up like Syria, Yemen, Lebanon, and Palestine with US and Israeli planes hovering above. But they just dare not near our borders, let alone enter our airspace. Well, that's because of our strength.
Like we said, Iran's defense budget of 2021 saw a fine rise. But in 2018, with sanctions, this country's budget was reported at more than $13 billion at best, ranking it 18th in the world in terms of military expenditures. The report was by the same Stockholm International Peace Research Institute, SIPRI.
We are amongst the few 5-6 countries making submarines and UAVs, so we have sufficient equipment for a modern war without wanting to attack anyone. This, of course, doesn't mean anyone can attack us, and when that easily. Examples are the several strikes on Iran to put it in its place, while Iran responded in a way to show it's certainly not empty-handed.
The enemy is using all its might. Iran has grown so strong that in the power club, it sets an example for other countries far and wide. The enemy seeks proxy forces, and its wars are now by planes and UAVs, or in the form of electronic wars / cyber wars, psychological wars, and hacking and spreading rumors in cyberspace, or by satellite programs.
Iran's military strategy is basically deterrent, but in case of confrontation with or by a world power, probably America, Tehran could count on three legs. Deutsche Welle names these as 1. Defense before the border, namely the operation of Quds Force units outside Iran to attack U.S. forces if necessary. 2. The use of long-range missiles to strike further away U.S. targets. Or 3. An attempt to shut down the Strait of Hormuz and send global energy markets into a death spiral. Give or take, since 2020, with some 523,000 active duty forces and another 350,000 reserves, Iran has the largest standing military in the Middle East or West Asia. The active forces are comprised of 350,000 in the regular army and at least 150,000 in the IRGC. The Iraq-Iran war ended in an effective stalemate and a ceasefire after some 8 years and after more than 500,000 soldiers and civilians were killed, to say the least. It was in the spring of 1988 that the two countries agreed to accept a United Nations-brokered ceasefire under Security Council Resolution 598 that finally recognized Iraq as the aggressor or initiator. Earlier, international organizations, particularly the UN Security Council, had remained silent about Iraqi atrocities in Iran. For an 8-year Iraq-Iran war, the UN only issued 8 resolutions, whereas on the 7-month Iraqi occupation of Kuwait years later, it issued 180 resolutions.
That'll be it for today, although we should be returning pretty soon with the matter of offense and defense. For now, thanks for commemorating Khorramshahr with us, the city of bliss and bounty, which for its plight was nicknamed Huninshahr, city of blood and sacrifice.
Cultural news. Social news. Scientific news. Artistic news. With delight.
The meadows in the foothills of the Swiss Alps have turned white these days, with locals calling it May snow. But it has nothing to do with snow. It's all about narcissus blooms covering the hills above the town of Montreux. Locals call the scene May snow because it looks like a blanket of snow from a distance. The flowers have been a tourist attraction since the 19th century, but factors such as urbanization have caused their decline in the past few years. Humans have disrupted the turtle survival for years due to their greed for meat, eggs, skin, and shells. But the decreasing population of the species is creating conscious of conservation. Cambodians have released hundreds of turtles of an endangered variety into the wild on World Turtle Day. About 600 Cantor's giant soft-shell turtles were let into a river in northeastern Cambodia. After people collected the species from a holding pool, Cambodian monks blessed the tiny creatures, then set them free. The Wildlife Conservation Society was the organizer of this event. It said that only a few records of Cantor turtles have remained in Laos, while they have mostly been wiped out in Vietnam and Thailand. The body has so far released over 1,500 hatchlings into the wild in 2022. Artists in a small town in the United Kingdom have created a massive bumblebee mural, hoping to raise awareness about this vanishing species. The mural was painted on the playing field of a primary school in the town of Haptonbridge. It was debuted on International Bee Day. The artist used paints typically used to draw lines for football pitches. Scientists say rising temperatures and heavy pesticide use are contributing to the decline in the number of bumblebees across Europe and North America. They say the population reduction rate is consistent with mass extinction of a species altogether. Children at a school have also created a wildflower meadow to help encourage bees to pollinate. A print art exhibition chronicling nearly a century's worth of artistic achievements by a Chinese woodcarver has been unveiled in the city of Suzhou near Shanghai. The carved into wood exhibit features nearly 80 of Huang Yongyu's wood blocks and prints. Woodblock printing is a form of Chinese art dating back hundreds of years. In this form, patterns are carved out of a thick sheet of wood to create a type of multi-layered surface. Then ink is applied in various stages to print the image and its colors. The humble 98-year-old artist said during his years of practicing art, he learned that sincerity mattered more than technique. The exhibition was launched in collaboration between Suzhou Museum and the Beijing Fine Art Academy.
Persian fallow deer is a unique but endangered species known for its sleek and spotted body. In this report, our correspondent Youssef Jalali takes us on a quick tour around one of the world's few protected shelters of Persian fallow deer in Iran's city of Sari.
We had to keep quiet and avoid making any sounds to film them, as they are shy and swift, and the slightest sound could send them sprinting and jumping away. Over 60 Persian fallow deer roam in Dashtinaz Wildlife Refuge in Iran's northern city of Sari. The endangered species is carefully protected here to be safe from predators and poachers.
The Persian fallow deer is native to Iran's Khuzestan province, but due to loss of habitat and threats posed to them by predators such as jackals and wild cats, they are endangered and need to be protected in semi-natural refuges like this one.
Persian fallow deer are mainly indigenous to open woodland areas spanning from East Mediterranean coasts to West and Southwest Iran. By 1875, they had gone extinct in all of their main habitats, except in southwest Iran. After a captive breeding program, the population has rebounded from only a handful of deer in the 1960s to over 200 individuals in Iran.
Dashtinaz Wildlife Refuge is 55 hectares wide. It was introduced in 1962 as a shelter for the Persian fallow deer when the species was on the brink of extinction. At that time, five deer were captured and translocated to this refuge. Over the past six decades, their number have been multiplied through captive breeding.
The Persian fallow deer is a rare ruminant mammal belonging to the family Cervidae. They're physically larger than other fallow deer, and their antlers are bigger and less palmate. Their special beauty has turned this sanctuary into a hot tourist attraction in Iran's north.
This sanctuary is a tourist destination for visitors who would like to see the Hyrkanian forests in Iran's north and at the same time enjoy the wildlife and learn about efforts made to save the Persian fallow deer from extinction.
In 2015, the Persian fallow deer was registered in the IUCN Red List of Threatened Species. Dashtinaz authorities hope through continued captive breeding, the population of these special creatures will soon reach the desired number, and hopefully they will be reintroduced to their natural habitat in southwest Iran.
While they live far from their original habitat, these alluring creatures feel at home here, where they will be safe from the dangers lurking outside, which may lead to their extinction. So here, Persian fallow deer continue to embellish the nature and charm visitors with their beauty. Yusuf Jalali from Dashtinaz Wildlife Refuge in Sari.
The Light is a bulletin in which we bring you a lot of interesting news in different fields like animals' life, cultural events, funny trending news, and more from every corner of the world.
The lush green oasis near Sudan's capital, Khartoum, has turned into a haven for dozens of exotic bears from all over the world. The sanctuary shelters over 100 bears of 13 different species. Here, visitors can feed lovebirds, parakeets, rosella bears, and many more. The owner of the sanctuary says he trained the bears over the years to make them human-friendly. Akram Yahia says he has a passion for bears and enjoys it when people come around to see the sanctuary. The sanctuary, which is part of the Marshall Nature Reserve, is a welcome break for the people from the hectic life in Khartoum and nearby cities.
He tried to create an environment that doesn't exist in Khartoum. These environments exist in other parts of Sudan, such as in the west of Sudan, in the east of Sudan, in rainy areas. These areas have environments such as this one, and perhaps even more beautiful. He created this environment in Khartoum, where there is not nature at all.
Domestic and foreign tourists are allowed there only 2 to 3 hours a day, the limited hours or so that the bear's living environment is not disturbed. The owner built the 400 square meter sanctuary 4 years ago. Over the years, he has added trees, garden, pond, and mist nozzles for cooling off against Sudan's scorching heat. Yahia says he wants to expand the reserve in the future. Indonesians have held a dazzling event to celebrate Vesak, a day traditionally observed by Buddhists in South Asia and Southeast Asia. People gathered at the sprawling Borobudur Temple in central Java and released lanterns into the sky. That's part of prayers marking the birth, enlightenment and death of Buddha, a spiritual teacher who lived during the 6th century BC. The release of lanterns symbolizes letting go of negativity. The occasion lasts 3 days, which includes collecting holy water, sending off lanterns, and meditation. This year, the event was limited to some 1,200 people because of the coronavirus risk. Because of the outbreak of the pandemic, the ceremonies typically receive 20,000 people at the massive temple complex.
A group of over a dozen penguins has been released back to the sea after being given a second chance to live.
The condition of these specimens, which fortunately could be reinserted, is very calm to find. They are animals that appear stranded on the coast, found with malnutrition, dehydration, hypothermia, and a high degree of parasitism. Specialists call this condition the stranded penguin syndrome.
The penguins were rescued and taken to the Mundo Marino Foundation, where they were rehabilitated. They were kept warm and were fed liquids until they could eat fish again. Before their release, blood and other samples were taken and a chip was implanted to track them. One of the penguins was a southern rockhopper, which is a species listed as endangered. Biologists at a rescue center say there are many reasons why penguins get stranded and malnourished. These include overfishing, global warming, and other environmental changes. Thousands of people crowd into the British city of Norwich to watch a 2-kilometer-long string of dominoes topple, while winding through town. Some 7,500 breeze blocks were set up for the event. The dominoes slinged through street buildings, windows, and even climbed up stairs and trees. The toppling lasted 30 minutes. The moving sculpture was installed across the city with the help of some 200 volunteers. The artistic director said the work was chosen partly because it was a spectacle and both disrupted the city and engaged its people.
There's a sense of anticipation that goes with the work. You would have seen people around town at the moment. Everybody's asking, what's going on? What's going on? And then when they realise what it is, then there's this sense of, oh, and when are you going to knock it over? So that it's a sculpture also that gets destroyed in many ways. And that's really part of the work as well. I mean, I like to think about it as a child almost playing with the city. You know, they're setting everything up and we all know they're going to knock it down at some point. And that's fun.
Daniel Bryan said he was excited about the project because it looked like a child had taken over the city with the joy of knocking down dominoes. The cascading dominoes ran through two cities, eventually ending at the site of Norfolk and Norwich Festival of Arts. The organizers say the goal of the installation was to bring unity to the community.
IRIB English Radio.
This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.